speak about emotions and working with emotions in the meditation practice. Some of you will have seen the Buddha images, right? These stone or wood statues, bronze images of the Buddha sitting perfectly still, lotus posture, hands at rest. And we might think that that's how we're supposed to be when we meditate. And sometimes we do take a very still posture. And inside, maybe we're not quite so still. We are not made of wood, and we are not made of bronze or of plaster. Our meditation practice is a practice of knowing the mind. And so we will experience emotions. We will experience a whole range of feelings. We're not going to be as stoic or as static as a Buddha image. As human beings, we have a tremendous capacity to feel a huge range of emotions. Some will be very uplifting and wholesome and delightful to the mind, and some will be unwholesome. They might feel dangerous. They might be scary. They might be agitating. Some will be easy to bear and we'll want them to last. And others will be very hard to bear, difficult to endure, and we'll wish that they would go away. But being able to experience a range of emotions is simply part of being a human being. And meditation is not intended to create an even emotional experience. Meditation does not create mediocrity. We don't dull out the emotions. There is a profound balance that arises in meditation, and the Pali term is tatramajatata, which really has a lot of T's in it. And it's translated sometimes as equanimity, but what it really means is evenness of mind, or in the middleness, being in the middle. And that is not being unemotional. It's having such a balanced mind that the mind is not disturbed by the changing states that arise moment by moment. In meditation practice, there is always a mental state that's present. We could say there's always an emotion, because every conscious moment has a mental state associated with it. We are meeting our experience with a quality of attention, with a quality of mind that is knowing it. Is the mind balanced? Is it wholesome? Is it steady? Is it stable? Is it mindful? As we know our experience. So there are many times in our meditation practice where very positive and wholesome states are going to arise. We might experience gratitude, the impulse of generosity. We might experience delight and curiosity, interest, or calmness and peacefulness and tranquility, or joy and rapture and bliss, or compassion and love. You might be walking, taking a walk, and see an injured bird and feel a spontaneous response of compassion. You can take a moment to feel that response and to know, what is the experience of compassion? How do we know that compassion just arose? How do we recognize those states? You might wake up at 3:30 in the morning and first feel a little grumpy, oh, it's 3:30, and then realize, oh, I'm actually feeling awake, and then feel pride. Well, what's that state of grumpiness? And what's that state of pride? Can you be mindful of those mental states and see how they arise and what arises with them? How do you recognize the difference between pride and grumpiness? And then you make a decision. Okay, I'm up. I might as well go to the meditation hall. There's nothing to do in here anyway, except to listen to my roommate snore. So you get up and you go to the meditation hall. And as you step out the door, you feel that cool, fresh air of the early morning hours and hear that very quiet, that quietness, especially if it's before the roosters have woken up. And that's 4 o'clock, okay. So you experience, and there's this inspiration, this joy in being alive, this joy in being awake, a very spontaneous response to just feeling the cool morning air. Well, that's an emotional response. Let's be mindful of that too and see, what is this joy? What is this delight? Is this craving and wanting, or is this a wholesome response to the moment? Sometimes we experience very subtle states in the meditation, tranquility, peacefulness, calmness, equanimity. Many people have a hard time distinguishing between these different states. They're all very quiet. Sometimes we experience happiness. And what's the difference between feeling desire for something and delight in something, or rapture, or bliss, or joy? They're all states of happiness. But what are the different kinds of happiness that we experience in our lives and in our meditation practice? When these kinds of subtle and wholesome states arise in the meditation, it's important to notice them. It's important to let them register, to let them resonate within us, to give them some space so that we infuse the mind and suffuse the body, permeate, fill, drench the mind and the heart with these wholesome states. When I say to fill the mind, drench the mind, suffuse and permeate the mind with these wholesome states, I am not saying, now grasp a hold of them and make them last or indulge in them. There can be a way that we just give space for the wholesome states that arise so that we know them very deeply and profoundly. It doesn't need to give rise to grasping. In fact, I recommend that you periodically pause when you're mindful and experience mindfulness. Actually experience the mind that is mindful. What is the quality of that mind? What is that mental state that we call being mindful? It's a very powerful, transformative state, but it's often so subtle that we might let it rush by and then dwell upon one tiny moment in the meditation when we were sleepy or when we were angry or when we were confused and forget about all those other moments when we were mindful. We do ourselves a disservice when we emphasize the strong, difficult emotions and don't give a fullness of attention to the mental states that are more subtle. So when there's mindfulness, experience that. When there's peacefulness, open to that. When there's compassion, be interested in that. When there's calmness, bring attention to experience the mind that is calm. we can receive these healing, healthy states. They are an important part of the emotional landscape. To some extent, as human beings, as animals, we are wired to emphasize the negative emotions, the fear, the anger. People tend to remember the smallest moment of fear and anger a lot longer than even longer moments of calmness or happiness or kindness. And I think it's natural as an animal to move away from danger. And so that has a strong impact on us. But we do ourselves a disservice if we respond to our emotions just at that animal level, even though the mind may be inclined naturally, instinctively, almost hardwired that way. We can consciously take time to focus on the wholesome and let those states become vivid and pronounced in our awareness so we are attuned to them and not skip over them because they're just not very dramatic. Concentration, as the concentration deepens in our meditation practice, many of these rather beautiful states will arise. They can become the focal point of our meditation. We don't grasp them, but we look at them. We observe them with mindfulness. We know what's present, and we know how it functions. We know how it affects the mind. We know how it changes. So there are times when gratitude, tranquility, delight, calmness arise. And usually they're subtle, but we're usually happy when they arise. Now, there are other times when anger and terror and fear, jealousy, envy, remorse, loneliness, confusion, insecurity, rage, a whole host of difficult or unwholesome emotions might arise. Many people want those to go away. They want to trade them for the first set. I'll get rid of this one and give me one of those, please. But our emotions are not really trading cards. We don't collect them when we can't exchange them for the ones that we prefer to have. We have to trust that we have the capacity of the heart to open to whatever is arising within our experience. Not only the things that we like, but whatever is arising. We can meet with a balanced, clear, mindful attention. It can be challenging to work with intense and difficult emotions. It's often difficult simply because we don't want to know them. And yet, they might be so strong that we can't avoid them. And so what many non-meditators do is to avoid the feelings just slightly. They think about them. They create a story about them. They act on them in a way trying to express or dispel or distance themselves just a little bit from what that feeling feels like when we sit in the silence and bear it. When anger arises and we choose we're not going to just dispel it by speaking on it or acting on it, and we're not going to just shift our attention to something that we want or pleasant, so we're going to trade anger for desire. No, we're just going to see, what is this anger? What is this rage? How do I experience it? We have to make the commitment to not dwell in the story, because the stories, the concepts, the content actually remove us from the direct experience of what's happening with that as that emotion arises within us and is felt. Telling ourselves who did what to me, why they did that to me, how I'm going to respond, what I'm going to say to them, why they have no right to have done that, and I didn't deserve this, on and on and on. That conceptualization keeps us from feeling the emotion as a pure and simple mental state. By blaming somebody else for it, we put the responsibility outside of us and disempower ourselves from actually feeling. What is this? How did it arise? What were the causes? What are the conditions? What are the effects? So when we work with emotions, we drop out of the story and we use the posture to compose ourselves as we settle into a clear experience of what that emotion might be. How is the emotion operating? How fully and clearly do we know it? Now, at this point, we're not interested in what we're angry about or what we're sad about. No interest in the content, no interest in the story. We're looking at the raw response to emotion. We're looking at what that emotion is in the mind. What arises with it? And what is incompatible with it? What can never arise together? Do we feel it in the body? If so, what part? What does it feel like? How do we recognize it? How would we describe it? What's fueling it? What's sustaining it? What's our inclination or relationship to it? Do we like it? Do we not like it? Are we afraid of it? Do we build up a sense of self-concept, self-identity based upon it? How do we see ourselves in relationship to that? What is the quality of mind that is knowing it? When we look at our mental states from the perspective of the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, we analyze mental states to see what are all the different mental factors that arise in a particular moment. And so in the meditation practices to discern the various mental states, what we learn to do is to give rise to various emotions. So in the training that I've been doing for the last several years, we sit and we develop very strong concentration so that the stability of mind is very, very, very steady. There's no interest in content, and we give rise to in a sequence of mental states. So there's a list of unwholesome mental states, and we go one after the other, 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 prompting, triggering, making that state arise within the mind and looking at it. And then each one we look at, we see what occurs with it and what never occurs with it. So, for example, in a state of greed, there will never be hatred, because we don't hate and want at the same time. We might hate 1 second and want in the next second, but in 1 second, in one moment, we are never hating and wanting at the same time. And we see that for ourselves when we go through a sequence of greed-rooted states, and then hatred-rooted states, and then delusion-rooted states. All the unwholesome states always have restlessness in them. They always have delusion in them. And we can see and experience the painfulness of restlessness, the pervasiveness of them. that's present not just in a state we would call restless, but in every greed-rooted state and every hate-rooted state. We also experience restlessness and delusion. When there's doubt, there is never desire or rapture. They simply cannot arise together. When there's aversion or anger, there is never rapture. But rapture can arise in wholesome states, and it can arise in greed-rooted states. So what we do in the training that I was doing is we literally go through this long list of mental states, one after another, again and again and again and again, while seeing, while hearing, while smelling, while tasting, while touching, and with mind objects. And then we go back through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mind objects through all of those states again and 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 again, on and on and on and on and on and on, day after day after day after day after day after day after day. When I was first given this instruction, I told the teacher that I didn't want to do it because I didn't want to spend a lot of time giving rise to unwholesome states. I figured those come naturally enough. I don't need to be in retreat to do this. He insisted that I do it. And I was really glad. It took a few months, but I was really glad because I had to see them clearly again and again and again and again to know them inside and out. You know, sometimes we say, I'm always angry, or I have a tendency to be angry. I think we may not have seen what anger is clearly enough. And so when you have repeated mental states, take the opportunity to look at them. Then you don't even have to go through this whole sequence triggering them. Look at them. You have to be stable enough, settled, calm, tranquil enough that you're not going to start going into a story of blame. But to just look at the mental state, one as it is, and to try to understand it is a very powerful thing. But we don't only look at the unwholesome states. We also look at the wholesome states. I liked that part. I never complained about that, because in every wholesome state, there is a series of beautiful factors that arise together. How do you distinguish between a moment of tranquility and a moment of mindfulness? Well, in every moment of tranquility, you will find that mindfulness is present. And in every moment of mindfulness, you will find that tranquility is present. So how do you distinguish between those two? There is a series of 22 beautiful factors that arise in every wholesome state. And I just want to read for you this series of factors. Faith, mindfulness, a shame of wrongdoing, the Pali term is hiri, and a fear of wrongdoing, and the Pali term is otapa. Non-greed, non-hate, an evenness of mind, tranquility of both the mental factors and the consciousness, lightness of both the mental factors and consciousness, malleability. Maybe you should translate that. Flexibility, malleability. Flexibility. Workability, that pliancy of mind, proficiency. It's a kind of effectiveness of mind, and an uprightness of mind. These arise in every wholesome state. But sometimes there's a dominance of one or another. And when there's a dominance of one or another, then we often highlight that single factor. But when we look closely at the state, we will find the presence of all of these. So as we are cultivating mindfulness, we are not just cultivating mindfulness. It's just the instructions would take too long if I went through that whole list every time I was asking you to be mindful. But when I ask you to be mindful, you are cultivating that whole list, and there's actually a few more. But those are the universal ones that arise in every wholesome state. So we investigate our experience of emotions. We feel them, we know them, but we also investigate them. One of the things that we'll look at when we sit and emotion arises is what is the relationship between the mental state and the thoughts that arise around it, the stories, the concepts. Because if there's a charged emotion, anger or fury or grief, then we have an opportunity to look and to see how we're relating to it. What are the feelings that are fueling the story? Is there grasping? Is there fear? Whatever we're doing at the time it arises, if we're sitting, the Buddha recommend stay sitting and know that state. Watch it arise and watch it pass. If, for example, fear arises when we're doing standing meditation, he says, stay standing until you have seen fear and let it move the attention to see the fear until it comes, it goes, it's known, and it's gone. So we use the stillness of the posture and the willingness to face whatever difficult emotions arise in the meditation as a kind of a framework to work with these difficult states. And we can use the body to feel how we feel it in the body. Where do we experience strong emotion? Maybe the stomach starts to turn. Maybe the knees start to shake. Maybe the heart starts to throb. Maybe there's a change of temperature, a change of pressure. Maybe there's a general state of contraction. Maybe our shoulders go up to our ears. What happens? It's very interesting to be sitting in a quiet room, relatively peaceful. Nobody's really bothering you. And suddenly you start to feel this contraction and this tightness and this emotional experience. And you get kind of all worked up around it. Well, what's getting worked up? It's a thought. It's an emotional response to a thought. And very often we relate so strongly to our thoughts that we experience the emotion based on the thought, the emotion based on the thought, the emotion based on the thought. And there's a kind of cycle where the thought keeps fueling the emotion and the emotion keeps fueling more thoughts. And they keep circling back and forth until we kind of drive ourselves nuts. So when we investigate, we see where we're locked up and fueling thoughts to emotions, thoughts to emotions, thoughts to emotions. The posture and the intention of mindfulness and the willingness to investigate it cuts through that cycle and looks at the emotion as the emotion, the body as the body, and the thoughts as the thoughts. So we see all the components, but we don't keep fueling the cycle. And as we see each component, we experience it fully. But when we're not fueling it, it doesn't perpetuate. It comes with the energy it came with, it's known, and then it passes. We can let the attention actually rest as we experience the emotion when we see it just as that. emotion, when we haven't bought into the story, we won't be frightened by it. We won't be disturbed by it. We'll experience the layers in the body. We'll experience the various associated mental factors. And it will just be what is happening in that moment. There is always a correlation, a connection between the body and the mind. We don't experience emotions just in the mind. We can't know anything without the body. And we can't know the body without the mind. Mind and matter, mentality and materiality, always arise together. Even our way of understanding, our way of processing emotions, is very physically based. There was a study of a group of subjects who had signed up to have Botox treatments. And they were asked to read sentences that were emotionally charged, some that were charged with sadness or anger, and some that were designed to elicit happiness. And they were timed as to how long it took them to understand and to process that emotion. I don't recall how they timed it, whether they did it with some kind of technical thing or if they just had to say, yeah, they understood the sentence or what. I don't remember the details. But what I do remember was that they were tested before the treatment and after the treatment. The length of time that it took them to process happy feeling, happy sentences, and understand the happy sentences was exactly the same before the treatment and after the treatment. But after the treatment, it took them a lot longer to process sad and angry feelings. Why? The Botox is used to paralyze the frowning muscles. And when we frown, when we make a gesture, we actually use the body to help process the emotion, to help comprehend the emotion, to help know the emotion. So something as simple as a frown helps us to actually understand what that is. Of course, they weren't so paralyzed that they didn't know what sadness was in the rest of their lives, but it took them a moment longer to make that mental adjustment. Now, I sometimes have sometimes I do day-longs at home where we have a day-long, and incorporated into the day of mindfulness meditation is some mindful movement work or some kind of embodied awareness or sensory awareness sort of process. Often we'll do yoga or qigong or something like that, but one of my favorite is the times when I've invited a theater director who works with actors to come in and to work with our group in a mind, because it's very much a mindful theater. They have to be very aware of their bodies. They have to be very aware of emotions and not attached to any of them, because they have to be able to go from one emotion to the next, to the next, to the next, to really be a good actor. And so we would use various gestures and take a gesture. And sometimes we would embody the gesture and experience the mindfulness that comes through the emotion and the gesture. And sometimes we would just be still, and other people would put our bodies in gestures. And it was remarkable how the emotion would be stimulated, even when we didn't know what the person was doing, you know, kind of like these body sculptures. Very interesting work. And just as a little experiment, for a moment, why don't you all close your eyes so that you don't get occupied with what somebody else is doing. And make a gesture of, I'll suggest a gesture, and I want you to just feel yourself not just moving into the gesture, but see if you can recognize if you are emotionally moving into that mental gesture to. So you actually move your body into a gesture of pleading, wanting, needing. And now shift to a gesture of giddiness. 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 Excited. Excited. Now shift to timid, shy. Confident, arrogant, nervous. Embarrassed. Ashamed. Guilty. Peaceful. Grateful. Mindful. Now, many of you had very subtle movements. I think many of you were just moving your mind. But some of you did move your bodies. When I said prideful, everybody went up. When I said fear or timid or shy, people went down. And you could feel like even just a shift in the shoulder blades or a shift of the arms opening or closing or kind of this way or that way. Can you feel a difference in the emotional life? We can tune into the body as much as we tune into the mind as we explore the emotions. So when we speak of being mindful of the emotions in meditation, we're not just talking about some abstract mental thing where you just count mental factors. You can also be mindful of how you hold yourself, how you walk, how you sit, how you feel in the body. Whatever emotions we're experiencing, I guarantee that they are changing. Some people tell me I've been angry all day. Not possible. It's just not possible. Anger doesn't last all day. It's a momentary experience. It may be that you had many, 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 many moments of anger that day. But anger is a momentary experience. It arises in a moment of contact. And then it dissipates, it ends. So as we work with emotions, you can look at the momentary characteristic of it. Just see it for what it is. And then be fresh the next moment. Because maybe a bird is twittering. And you're not very angry at that. Or maybe you're thinking about something and you're sorry or you're sad. And then you take a bite of tahina and you feel safe. all is well. You can trust your own capacity to feel any emotion. They're just momentary experiences. They arise due to conditions, and they pass away. There is no emotion that is going to harm you. It's only a momentary experience. And the more clearly we're able to see them, the more fully we're able to experience them, the freer we will be in relationship to them. They will not, difficult emotions will not control or dominate our lives when we experience and feel them. It's only when we indulge in the story of them. It's only when we fuel them with thoughts, emotions, thoughts, emotions, thoughts, emotions, thoughts, emotions, thoughts, emotions, and have not seen them clearly, have not yet been willing to sit with them and see them arise and pass, arise and pass, arise and pass, arise and pass. There are times when emotions will be too strong for the energy and the calmness that you have at that moment. We don't always have the ability to go right into the heart of a difficult emotion and sit through it to ride it out. But sometimes we do. And you have to sense for yourself what is a skillful way of working with difficult emotions when they arise. If the energy is there and the stability is there and the interest is there and the commitment is there, then you can just stay steady with it and see, what is this? What is this? But if you find that the mind keeps getting into a reaction to it, the story gets dominant, the fear starts to grow, or the anger starts to turn into rage, then it might be better to back off a little bit, give yourself a little space, dispel it with a walk, or a cool shower, or shifting your attention just to the breath or as a neutral object. So even though I'm speaking a lot about emotions, it doesn't mean just because an emotion arises that now you have to pay attention to it. You have to find the right time to explore these difficult states. But I think we all have to see our difficult emotions at one point or another to know them completely. Anger, lust, greed. We have to sit in stillness and see it arise and know it fully and see it pass away. It'll move through us like a wave, no different than any other phenomenon, no different than a bird twittering. Waves of spontaneous grief might arise, and they'll be fully known, but without the story of what we lost. Fear might arise, and we might feel the trembling. We might know the quivering. We might sense the mind in its state of confusion and uncertainty. But we'll also be mindful of it and know that we have the courage to feel that fear and to not be paralyzed by it. It doesn't need to stop us. We can see how fear functions. It'll arise, it'll be felt, it'll be known, and it will pass. Simply knowing that fear is fear takes a lot of the fear away from it. We don't need to indulge in something that's pleasant, and we don't need to push away something that is unpleasant. We can know the force of desire and the force of aversion without perpetuating desire and aversion. We can bring mindfulness to these difficult mental states so that we take desire as the object of the mind, of the investigation. We take aversion as the opposite, as the object, and we look at it and know it. Interestingly, mindfulness never arises at the same time that we are angry. Ever. Mindfulness never arises at the same time we are lustful and greedy. Never. Because if we're mindful, we won't be indulging in those states. It would be a wholesome state. But what happens is we can take lust, we can take hatred as the object for mindfulness. We're not then hating or lusting, but it is the object that's being known by a mindful mind. So we go back and forth when we talk about being mindful of, for example, hatred or anger. We're not being mindful and angry at the same time. We're going usually back and forth a little bit between a moment when we got angry and now we're mindful of it. So anger becomes the object. And then we're mindful and angry, mindful and angry, mindful and angry. And pretty quickly, mindfulness will get the upper hand. Simply because mindfulness is stronger than all the unwholesome states. If you're new to meditation, you may not believe it yet. But please hear that, whether you believe it or not. Mindfulness is stronger than all the hindrances and all the unwholesome states. And the presence of mindfulness dispels them all. It's just that usually we have to go back and forth a bit to get to know them fully. It will take a lot of energy, effort, if the emotion is strong. And sometimes we'll be tired because of it, because emotions are taxing to the energy. We can feel very, very tired if there are strong emotions. But it's worth conjuring up the energy. It's worth bringing forth the effort to face whatever our habitual patterns are and to learn to be with the full landscape of the emotional life, to be willing to be with the difficult, strong emotions, and to be willing to really let those positive, beautiful emotions resonate within us. If you do a generous act, maybe you've helped in the kitchen that day. It's a kind and generous thing to serve people, to do your part, to give a gift of time that helps other people in this meditation retreat. It's a beautiful thing. Let yourself feel the joy of service. It's a beautiful emotion. It's not to become all prideful and now I start to conjure up what a wonderful person I am and how great I am. I chop these carrots. They are absolutely perfect. And we get all like arrogant about the service that we did and we want a gold star. We want somebody to admire our carrots. No. But after you finish your service, take a moment to just notice how you feel. Reflect on the good that you did and let that resonate. Give yourself space to let the good things that we do have an impact. Because there's no doubt that we give too much space for the mistakes that we make in our lives, right? Sometimes we make some little tiny mistake and we beat ourselves up for a week about it. And yet, how many good things did we do in that week that we didn't bother to let resonate, to let fill our hearts? So don't miss the calm moments, the tranquil moments, the moments of gratitude and generosity. Freedom in meditation is not going to be found in the absence of emotion. But we will discover perhaps a dramatic transformation that occurs in how we relate to our emotions, how we respond to intense feelings. With wisdom and with mindfulness, we'll find that we'll be able to trust ourselves to be present with any emotion that arises, grasping, fear, anger, whatever. And we'll have the confidence to know it fully, without engaging in stories of blame, without having to fix the problem, without having to control the situation, without needing to go grasp comfort or addictions, without needing to distract ourselves from it. We'll know that emotions each have their own energy, their duration, based upon the conditions that gave rise to them. One could say their karma. And if we don't fuel them with the stories, they will simply be known. They'll arise and they'll pass away, and they'll be replaced by the next experience that we will be equally present for. Emotions are not static. They're not steady. They don't define who we are, and they will not determine how we act. We'll have the freedom to know the emotion, to know how we feel, to know how it affects the mind. And then we will choose how to act, how to respond with wisdom. When we free our minds from the entanglements of the stories, when we're not feeding the emotion with thoughts again and again, then we reflect and we will wisely and almost naturally, it will feel that the wisdom will come right into our actions, into our expressions of body, into our expressions of speech, and into our expressions of thought. Let's have a couple of quiet minutes, please.